I thought he was talking about somebody else. I don't recognise that guy at all. But anyway, here we are, and it's great to be here in Cork. I'm delighted to be here. And as I was looking at the profile of the people here, I was kind of figuring out that virtually all of my poetry is universally unacceptable for an audience like this, but I'm stuck with it now anyway. I write mainly rural poems, so we'll see how we get on in a city location.
I'm rural,
that's good. So brace yourselves, beware. This one is called Days of Fake Tan. I should have refused to get in once I saw the state of the inside of the bridal car. I should have shouted, no, I will not marry you if this is the way you treat me on the morning of our special day. A hired white Mercedes, driven by that aegis of a brother of yours, soon to be my brother-in-law. Inside where there should be champagne and flowers, a half bag of calf nuts, jump leads and a drum of diesel. I should have ran a mile. I should have screamed to you that I would not go through with it. We could have cancelled the hotel and the photographer, divided the cake. But I know what you'd have said, and your mother, what would it look like in front of the neighbours, and the expense they had gone to buying new clothes, and the talk that had been in the pub and around the village for months, years even. Your family never get over it, and we couldn't have that. I bundled up my dress as best I could and climbed into the white Mercedes, careful not to knock over the half bag of calf nuts or spill the diesel. And I told myself that you were a kind, loving and considerate man who would go to the ends of the earth for me and your mother and the neighbours. That you wouldn't waste money, which is why you had your brother use our wedding car to feed the calves in the farm your father bought when land was cheap. And that your brother, my soon-to-be brother-in-law, had probably jump-started the Hi-Mac and topped it up with diesel on his way to collect me. I was wrong there. We diverted round by the Hi-Mac, and I held the strainer as he filled the yellow god with diesel, and then I climbed into the cab and turned the starter as he revved the Mercedes in an attempt to jump-start the digger, which didn't work. Together, we bled the diesel lines. Him in his hired suit, me in my white dress and fake tan without a bridesmaid in sight. Until the earlock was cleared and the machine purred approval, then and only then did he take me to the church, fashionably late and stinking of diesel fumes and calf nuts and dung. When you proposed that we sort this thing out, I said okay, because there was no point not to. I knew that every special occasion would be choreographed to accommodate calves and heifers, and cows and bull. That my birthday, if you remembered it, would be moved to suit the March schedule, which took priority, and always would take priority. That our holidays would be an afternoon in Enscrone when the silage was finished. That the children would be children of the land. That I would cook and clean and milk and drive tractors and pull calves, and sow and weed and harvest crops. That getting my hair done would consist of washing it with fairy liquid once a week from the back kitchen sink, if there was time. I went through with it because Johnny McCormack married Pauline Finn last August, and I knew that James Kelly would never return from America, and all the girls I went to the convent with were married, drove their children to school in Ford Fiestas. That at 37, true romance was for books, and all I'd get was a bid. I went through with it because I knew the days of fake tan were well and truly behind me. I'm delighted to see that you haven't left after that. And now that I have the tone set, this next one is another love poem. In my misspent middle age, which followed my misspent youth, I spent my time browsing through the newspapers and things as you do, the Farmer's Journal and the like, and I was always impressed by the ads in the Lonely Hearts section. So this poem has a longish title. It's called Single Woman 38, Broad-Minded, GSOH, Considered Good-Looking, Wanting More from Life. Breaks it off with Bachelor Farmer, 56. And that's only the title. Oh yes, you are quite a catch, all right. With your shiny, massive Ferguson 35X, and the very mention of your new PZ Haybop was quite simply orgasm-inducing. And in your new Wellingtons and perfumed with silage, you made my eyes water for the want of you. But I wasn't enough. You wanted others too, those slim Frisian heifers with the shitty tails and day-glow ear tags, and I was no match for your mother's washing and cooking and cleaning, or ironing your Green Hills thermal vest and darning your worn socks with grey wool, not to mention her masculine prowess at mucking out the cowhouse. And so, John James Murphy, I'm breaking up with you. No more will I wait for you outside the school hall on Tuesday nights in a skimpy skirt, hungry eyes penetrating me, till you finish the 7 euro game of 25. Or on Thursday evenings till the march is over, to be treated in Franco's Formula One fast foods, or make a fool of myself in the yearly Queen of the Plough pageant while you drink porter at the bar. And when it gets warm, and it does get warm at the Queen of the Plough pageant, sweaty even, and when you remove your jacket, displaying 6 inches of yellowish long johns pulled up over your plaid shirt, will I be there to hold your 20-year-old St. Bernard tweed to the cloakroom and look after the pink ticket number 91 for you afterwards. I'm leaving, John James Murphy. Leaving for Dublin or England or Cork or Navan. Anywhere. Anywhere away from here. And when I settle into my new place, I'll write to you. Not to tell you where I am and not to say I miss you, but to remind you that the black cow will be due for calving on August the 27th. The day your mother goes to knock for the solemn novena, and you had better find yourself a new girlfriend by then, or you might have to pull this one yourself. Staying with love poems, this is the title from the collection which was published by Salmon Poetry. They put their professional integrity on the line. Last summer, 12 months. This is called Are You Ready? When the row with the wife has gone on for over a week, and your neck and lower back hurt from sleeping on the dirty green sofa, and when the chips you got in the McDonald's drive-thru have fallen into the space around the handbrake, and you're sorry now that your toenail clippings are still there, and you made the mistake of putting your only white shirt into the washing machine along with the lawnmower, are you ready? Are you ready to admit that it was you who ran over Bozo in 1997 and broke his front legs? That the £100 she saved for Santa went on the fourth place certainty in the 3 tin at Newmarket? That it was you who ran up the phone bill on the sex lines? That you do sometimes drink and drive? That you occasionally wear your wife's lingerie? That the job interview really was golf? That you do secretly fancy Susan Kelly, that you once voted for the PDs. Are you ready? Are you ready to admit? Are you ready to admit that maybe it was you that was in the wrong all along? This is, we changed the tone slightly a little bit. This is called A Life. You spent years going to dances. The Maple, the Arcadia, and festival marquees pitched in aftergrass. And if the one you liked wouldn't shift, you pretended you liked the one you shifted. You shifted Noreen Cassidy in 1968, but her father shifted you when he heard about you after mass. You had an eye for Anne Danaher, and for her cousin from Manchester in the yellow hot pants. You couldn't understand when Kathleen Byrne refused you in 1972. Her land was next to yours. You drank bottles of stout with 3 generations of lads and made smart comments about their girlfriends behind their back. You were waiting, you said, for a good-looking young one. Someone with prospects. Someone like Teresa Dowd, the district nurse. She found you last Friday, stretched in the cottage for over a week. 14,000 stuffed behind a plate in the dresser. A picture of Big Tom on the mantelpiece. You're very kind with your applause, and don't encourage me, that's all I say. This one is called Paddy Nocton. Paddy Nocton lay in bed the morning of his 66th birthday. On the locker, a mug with his teeth, a battery clock, and a gold watch from his colleagues after 43 years as a postman. He won't miss the run, he tells himself. It had changed. Gone was the welcome of the Campbells, glazed with plywood by some relative in England, when Nora was put into the mental home. And the hippies that moved into where old Pete Riley had lived, or the Dublin crowd in Shaughnessy's. Not the same, any of them. Nor the three generations of Kirby's. He could never remember whose wife was who. And as for the children, where did he get the strange names for them? He wouldn't miss the dogs or the cats, the stench from Mrs. Hessian's clothes as she leant on the bonnet of the van to tell him nothing, or O'Connor's, and trying to get the solicitor's letter signed when Donal went off with the skinny remedial teacher, leaving poor Denise to sort out the mess. He wouldn't miss the hens outside Flynn's, and inside too, he suspected, or the complaints of the widow Hunt when he didn't call before three. How can I deal with my business at this hour of the day? Or the parcels for Kennedy one, who ran some sort of mail order business over the internet. Or the ESB bills, aircom bills, and bags of election literature, and promotions from DIY stores. And the postcards offering paint jobs promising to last a lifetime for the 193 houses he served. He wouldn't miss the potholes, or the tractors with slurry tanks or round bales blocking the road. He wouldn't miss the cold mornings or the constant rain, or the branches whipping the windscreen on boreens leading to pensioners who rarely went out. He'd miss none of it. Not even the £20 notes and glasses of whiskey at Christmas from the old stock, which led to the broken mirrors and dents on the van. And he wondered what time his replacement, Peg Ronan's son, would call today and what he'd bring. Would it be a birthday card from his sister in Chicago who never forgot, or a letter from the health board calling for a checkup? He sat up, looked at the clock. He was at Dixon's at this time yesterday and the day before, and every day since the vans replaced the bicycles. He leant forward and picked up the watch, blew onto the glass and wiped it with his sleeve. The last thing he needed really, time. He leant again, this time reaching for his digoxin tablets, tipping them out onto the duvet before counting out the days they'd last. I parked the car out there in the main road, you know, on the St. Patrick Street, I think it's called. And as I was parking it, I noticed there was a few kids fighting across the street. I don't know how serious it was or anything, but they were kind of having an exchange of views anyway. And there and then I decided I'd read this poem tonight. It is a poem from when I was growing up in Mayo, where I come from. It's called Ritual. And one of the things about it is Clare Morris Town Hall, where we went every Sunday night, was divided in two halves. The men were on the left-hand side and the women were on the right-hand side. But strangely, the men's toilets were on the side where the women were, and I could never figure that out. I didn't for a long time. But only looking back on it now, but of course it was glaringly obvious why. This is called Ritual. In our best clothes and marinated in brute, we headed out the door at 8 or maybe 8:30, thumbing and knowing there were no cars on the road, a pessimistic optimism, a triumph of hope over history, and the cars that never came didn't bring us, but somehow we got there. A few fast pints if we were served, then onward to the Sunday night dance in the town hall. Bouncers greeted in maroon jackets and ridiculous sticky bows. We heard the band warming up as we counted our change. Testing 1-2, testing 1-2. Businesslike, we headed left, like in church, to the men's side, for it was business. We were hoping for a return on our investment. The architect, obviously not a dancer, but the toilets the other way around. Maybe he was just taking the piss, or the builder held the plans upside down. When the testing was done, they started. A few fast numbers, ladies and gentlemen, and a stampede across the waxed navel for the hand, or more likely the sulk, of the girl of our dreams. All, as it seemed, the object of the dreams of all the men, lads and boys there. And they all reached for her, vultures plucking at the flesh. Sometimes we were worried her arms would be disconnected under the tight red jumper, counting ourselves lucky to get a quick stint of her Charlie as she passed us on our way to the floor. We wouldn't pull, of course, so we headed to the men's toilets, glad they were on the women's side, trying to make it look like that's where we were headed all along, not wanting to admit the mortal sin of rejection. Maybe the architect was himself a sinner and knew we'd need sanctuary someday from ourselves. And then somewhere it happened, inexplicably and inevitably. The vocabulary of the night punctuated by flailing arms and weighty punches. Who do you think you're pushing? Hold my jacket. I'll see you outside. The maroon-clad mercenaries involved themselves, and in the pulling and dragging, sweating and swearing, we noticed the girl in the red jumper disappear under the arm of a scrawny townie, and with them our hopes for the week. Outside, the losers took stock, swore revenge, torn suits and blood-stained shirts. You could easily mistake them for the winners. We were glad to take the lift in the Mini or the Cortina that last 100 yards, after walking 6 miles, stopping at the roadside wells, trying to satisfy our thirst for life. Of course, none of the people here will identify with that. It's all different now, isn't it? Much more sophisticated than that. This poem has a Cork connection. When I was a kid growing up, I suppose that's the time everybody's growing up, isn't it, when they're a kid? But Cork was a dreaded place for people from Mayo. It was associated with coal, really, and immigration. Abandoned railway. They cleared the overgrowth from the railway it closed in 1975 after 80 years. They've repaired the fences, replaced the mileposts, removed the barbed wire crossing the track erected by farmers whose cattle had grazed undisturbed on bright spring afternoons. Horsetail and thistles fold under my feet. I walk these sleepers between Kilshamaugh and Claremorris through our farm by the lake, and I think of my ancestors on a one-way ticket. I see simply crafted steel gates, riveted and rusted, rotted timbers, reminders of hard-drawn copper wire on once proud telegraph poles that carried signals to gatekeepers at level crossings, the 155 or the 310, often running late. I see the faces of children pressed against the window, counting the fields on school tours, and the suitcases of tourists on the annual outing to Salt Hill. I glance at the sheds and backs of houses, gardens with onions and cabbage and potato stalks beginning to flower. I look down again quickly to check my steps on the rotted oak, careful not to miss the inconsistent spacing at the joint in the metals. This was the railway that my uncle worked on, checking the sleepers and the wedges, the bolts and the joints, the fences and the signals. This was the track that the train ran on that took his brother and his sister, his cousins and his neighbours to Cove to board a ship to America. This was the railway that brought the youth from Sligo, from Colooney and from Laney, from Tobercurry, Curry and Charlestown, from Swinford, Kilchimahan and Claremorris, from Ballandine, Milltown and Castlegrove, from Tuam, Ballyglunin and Athenry, where immigrants joined from Galway and Woodlawn, Ballinasloe and Athlone. This track collected them from Crockwell and Loughrea, from Ardrahan, Gort and Tubber, from Crusheen and Innes, where the West Clare Railway evacuated hopefuls and surrendered them to immigration. This track carried the train from Ardsullis and Quinn, from Ballycar and Newmarket, from Six Mile Bridge and Cracklow, from Meelig and Long Pavement into Limerick and to Killonan and Boher, to Drumkeen and Palace, from Oola and Limerick Junction, where he and they changed trains, going to Inley, Knocklong and Kilmallock, Charleville, Buttevant and Mallow, Moornabbey, Rathdruff, Blarney and Cork, through Tivoli, Dunkettle and Little Island, Glanthorn, Fota and Carrigaloe, through Rushbrook and on to Cove, never to return. We'll change things around now slightly a bit. This is called Misfits. After he completed a FOSS course on computers, Tom Fitz browsed eBay for a gearbox for his Hillman Hunter, which had been laid up for a while. Eventually he found one from a breaker with good feedback located in Kilkenny. To defray the carriage costs, Tom looked around for other bargains in the area and spotted a mahogany effect coffin with metal substitute handles and trim. Never used, the seller in Wexford claimed. The coffin seemed attractive. It had a low reserve, and since his wife wasn't all that well, Tom put in a bid. He was soaked to the skin and perished with the cold when he arrived in Camolin on the Ferguson 20. So much for the sunny southeast. With great delay and considerable difficulty, Tom attached the coffin to the transport box, covering it with 1,000-gauge plastic from the co-op, and set off for Kilkenny and the gearbox. "I have a present for you," he told his wife once he regained consciousness back in Eastkey after the journey home. Mrs. Fitz was less than impressed, declaiming to her husband and to the neighbours that she wasn't gone yet, and would prove that to him in the bedroom later that night. An offer Tom couldn't accept after the hardship of the 4-day shopping expedition. To make matters worse, the gearbox didn't fit. The mounting bolts were in the wrong place. He suspected it might be from the Minx or the Avenger. Blasted anyway, he'd have to go back with it. While he was away, so that he wouldn't be going on to her about it, Mrs. Fitz put on her best dress, the one that she got for John Joe's wedding in 1989, and armed with a cushion from the suite in the sitting room, tried out the coffin for size. It was too small. That useless bastard of a husband of hers couldn't even get the right size coffin, and now he was gone back to the southeast, there'd be no changing it. She'd have to diet, lose a few pounds, and try and get into it. Tom's journey wasn't completely in vain. The breaker was in liquidation, but he did pick up a nice limousine bull calf in Cook's Grange on the way back. The animal jumped off the transport box a few times, and Tom carried him on his lap on the 20 most of the way home. Despite Copay's dosing with Arafat, the calf scour showed no sign of improvement until they were in Drumore West. Mrs. Fitz didn't die, but she did diet. She checked her size regularly, not on the scales, but in the coffin, while Tom was watching Shawadi Wadi on YouTube, or uploading images of his limousine herd onto Facebook. The coffin was very useful, as a blanket box in summer and as a turf box in the winter. It was deployed as a bed for Pauline, John Joe's wife, when they came to visit. John Joe slept in the bed with his daddy and mammy like he did before he married. Announcement. Sunday morning, as he finished first mass, Father Seamus told those who hadn't dashed off to get a parking space outside Costcutters that the weekly sick calls and visits to the elderly, normally carried out on Fridays, would have to be brought forward to Thursday this week, because he would be away on Friday and for a few weeks. He and Sister Josephine, she with the chest on her like Jordan the supermodel, were off to Rome, he said, to be married in St. Peter's Basilica by none other than Pope Benedict himself, with a reception afterwards in Castle Gandolfo. He said that five priests would be replacing him in the parish during his absence, but nobody heard that, such was their shock at the very prospect of the summer residence of His Holiness being rented out for weddings and the like. Sister Josephine would be attended on the day by her sisters Jacqueline, Jacinta and Joanne, while Shauneen, Shay and Shamie would fight it out, bare knuckled of course, for the title of best man, while a young altar boy, who was actually their 10-year-old son, would be page boy. Guests would be served with a range of altar wines, and the main course would be roast lamb of God, with loaves and fish for those that didn't eat meat. There was a stampede up the centre aisle to extend best wishes to the departing curate, as was to be expected. He thanked them, blessed them, and went to the sacristy for a sit-down and a smoke. It was safe to smoke, now that he had disconnected the smoke alarm. I'll only be about another hour and a half, so... Yeah. Profession of faith. At the 7:30 p.m. Mass in the Church of St. Killian and the Immaculate Conception, Clondalkin, on an autumn Saturday between the collections, Father Patton took time out to tell the assembled congregation that the traditional sign of peace, the handshake shared with those within reasonable reach and at the appropriate time, was to be done away with due to the threat of swine flu and the dangers of the propagation of same by bodily contact. The handshake was to be replaced, Father Patton said, by a pious gesture of the joining of the hands, one's own hands, fingertip to fingertip, palm to palm, upright at the chest in holy fashion, and the turning towards fellow worshippers in the same and neighbouring seats, and by a solemn bowing of the head. This would minimise the risk, Father Patton said, of spreading the swine flu germs. And so Father Patton proceeded between collections, with the consecration and such business, and the congregation prayed for the Old Testament-like destruction of swine flu and all its agents. The following morning in the Church of St. Killian and the Immaculate Conception, Clondalkin, and between collections, the same Father Patton made no mention whatsoever of swine flu or scoilia. Indeed, he never mentioned the fuckle, the 9 o'clock Mass being celebrated in the national tongue. And when there was a break in the collections, and when Father Patton could fit in the congregation and such business, and when it came time to offer the sign of peace, hands were proffered and shaken enthusiastically, and Gregory even left their seats and walked about the Church of St. Killian and the Immaculate Conception, and robustly shook the hands of fellow worshippers, like politicians on the eve of a by-election, and damn the care or mention of swine flu, Australia. And the congregation, like Father Patton, simply got on with matters of adoration, worship and prayer and collections. Father God Patton did stray from Anchanga Nashunta to relate in English that there would be another collection at all the Masses this weekend, and that the respectable men and women of the St. Vincent de Paul Society would have their baskets ready outside the Church of St. Killian and the Immaculate Conception in Clondalkin after the service was completed, and reminded the congregation, as if they didn't already know, that the Society of St. Vincent de Paul was a very worthwhile cause. And I wondered, would Father Patton get the Nobel Prize for advancements in medicine for his discovery that the swine flu virus was powerless in the presence of the Irish language, or would he simply be remembered as the old man who rambled on while the collectors emptied their baskets before calling again for another profession of faith. list here. This next one, before Jesse would put it in the book, I think she sent it to the Attorney General for approval. And it came back. Date as postmark. Dear service user, you may or may not have had a chest x-ray at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital, Drogheda, or at the Midlands General Hospital, Port Leash, or the Midwestern Regional Hospital, Innes, or at any other hospital in Ireland. We don't know. And irrespective of the results we gave you at the time, you may or may not have cancer. We don't know. If you're experiencing any pain or any of the symptoms of this or any other disease, please take something for it. Don't ask us what. We don't know. Signed, Mary Harney, TD, Minister for Health and Children, on behalf of the Health Service Executive, the Government and the people of Ireland. Two shorter ones. Hooded crows. Hooded crows explode from the sycamores. A lonesome collie announces neighbours, or maybe distant relatives, arriving for the removal. Poor old John Joe, he was a decent skin. Never a bad word for anyone. Heads gently nodding agreement. Kathleen offers curd cake and strong tea in striped mugs. The bride that might have been had she not stayed to look after her mother. It won't be long now till time reclaims this house and the hooded crows fly through on their way back to the sycamores. And this one, never black. What colour is the sky today, you asked. I wanted to say it was blue. Grey, I said. Dark grey or light grey? Both, I said. You said, I'm really lucky. The sky is always blue. Azure during the day, indigo in the evening, and Prussian blue at night. But never black. It's never black. The flowers are always in bloom where you are, Mother. Intense. The grasses, a fertile green, never need mowing. The weeds behave themselves like you wished I had when I was 6 and 7. Now you are 6 and 7 and getting even younger. Getting even younger. Two more love poems and that'll be about it. You'll be glad to hear. Daily worship. Delighted that Father Lula, the parish priest, has contracted a small bout of Alzheimer's, Father John Paul is pleased to have gotten the weekday morning mass gig. Today he moves his chair slightly to the left, as Mrs. Dolan, a woman he can't stand, obscures his view of Olivia, a national school teacher and daily communicant seated in the fourth row. He watches as she attentively listens, as Sister Cuntata reads from the letters to the Hebrews, and wishes that the psalm of his right hand was on her left knee, Olivia's, not Sister Cuntata's, whose knee last saw the light of day on the 9th of May, 1942. Father John Paul, for whom his mother, sitting in the front row, has hopes he will one day ascend to the highest calling like his famous namesake, can't wait for Holy Communion, his favourite sacrament, the time he gets closest to Olivia, inhales her perfume, sneezing sometimes, bless you, Father, and gazes ecclesiastically at her pert nipples, struggling to burst through her pink bra, distracted briefly by the sun's reflection through the stained glass window, onto her shiny tights. Today she's there again, and he glances at her dark lined eyes
wanting to place it on her tongue, but she holds her hand out and said, and him obliges, Corpus Christi. Amen. And imagines it dropping into her cleavage, and under the good teaching of Pope Benedict the 16th and the 15th that went before him, mere mortals are debarred from searching the cleavage of young female communicants for stray holy bread. He indulges his divine right and imagines finding it wedged in there somewhere. When she turns, he watches her generous bum wiggle as her slingback heels tap Morse code on the mosaic of his existence, hoping his clerical garb hides his true feelings for her. And in reply, dear Father John Paul, you have renewed my faith. You have made me a Christian again, a mass-going Roman Catholic, a daily communicant, devout. But it's all a lie, Father John Paul. It's all a lie. May God forgive me. May Pope Benedict the 16th forgive me. May Bishop Peter forgive me, for I'm a hypocrite, Father John Paul. Every morning at 8:30 Mass in St. Valentine's Church, I'm a hypocrite. And every day in St. Jude's National School, I'm a hypocrite. For it is you I truly worship. You, Father, yes, you. It is you I worship. Oh, dear God, forgive me, for I've broken the first commandment. It is you I long for. It is you I look for salvation, and I know it's wrong, Father. I know it's wrong, but it's no use. It's you I worship. It's for you, in the hope you might notice me, that I wear the skirts I wear and flagellate myself in these bastards of high heels. And it is you I am in think in the evenings when I bathe my feet in that awful concoction of seaweed and redox that my mother has ready. It is of you I think as I look to the children and high infants, picking out the ones I'd like to have had with you and giving them special attention. It is of you I am thinking while Sister Contata is rambling on about Exodus and Deuteronomy. It is before you I am kneeling at the consecration. And it is your body I am receiving at Holy Communion. Yes, oh yes, it is you. And when you place it on my hand, and you do place it on my hand so gently and so carefully, it is you, Father John Paul, I am consuming. As I make the sign of the cross and face the altar and turn carefully and slowly to make the sad journey back to the fourth row. What am I to do? What am I to do? I worship your short brown hair. I worship your biggish nose. I worship your left ear, which is slightly bigger than your right one, which I worship too. And more than anything else, I worship your mouth and your hands, wishing they were touching me now, Father John Paul. And I worship when you sometimes forget the words of the prayers. I worship the driver's seat of your green 1997 Opel Corsa, and the single bed, and I'm assuming it's a single bed, that you lie on in the parochial house with Father Lula. I dream of taking ill so you can anoint me. I dream of being bedridden so you can visit me. I dream of going to confession to admit my concupiscence so you can hear me. I dream, Father John Paul. I dream of someday sending you this letter. I dream of your reply. I do, Father John Paul. I do. Yours in worship, Olivia.
And I'm away. Paul was telling me that this is it's over 180 nights that you've ran here successfully, and I want to say congratulations, because it's absolutely fantastic, and well done to everybody. And I was delighted as well with the poetry challenge at the start. I thought it was a brilliant idea, and I thought there was some amazing stuff written in that as well. So well done. While I'm on the subject of numbers, might I remind you that there's 74 shopping days left to Christmas. Happy Christmas. And we've reduced the price of the book slightly due to the recession. I think everybody has to make their effort, you know. So it was €12 and we've reduced it to a tenner. And the publishers have used lovely soft paper.
So when you have it red, you can use it for something else as well. Other stuff, paper. In the national interest, of course. One final one on ecclesiastical matters. And a love poem to finish. This is called Half Eleven Mass. And the priest breathed in. And the congregation breathed in. And the priest opened his mouth to deliver the word of God. And the congregation opened their ears to receive the word of God. And it went over the heads of the congregation. And out the door and down the street to Aldi, where the thoughts of the congregation were queuing up for the hair dryers for $2.99 at 12 o'clock. And the priest was glad that he was bald. And the congregation were glad that he was bald. And Aldi were sad that he was bald. One less hair dryer for $2.99 at 12 o'clock. This is it. This is the final one. As I said, thanks again for everything, and looking forward now to hearing the rest of the poets tonight. So I'll leave you with this. It's called Disgusting. You won't believe it, Maura. He came at me last night with a yoke you could hang a pot of spuds on. Must be the steak I gave him for his tea. $7.95 it was in super value. I don't go to Lidl. You don't know where they get it from. And he meant it. Wanted to get at me, he did. Well, I'll tell you more, I was having none of it. I told him he hadn't mentioned it sooner. I wasn't ready. I guess chicken for tonight. Safer. I suppose he'd be like that now for the week. He goes that way. After me every night till it goes off him. Disgusting. I should have known. The blonde young one was on the telly on about foreign holidays. Legs and tits everywhere. But I think the steak had something to do with it. For $7.95, you'd want to be getting a bit of peace. Like something out of the circus he was, parading it around the room in front of him, showing it off to me, letting me know it was still working, putting me on notice. Chicken is safer. I'll get a chicken for tonight. I'll check the RTE guide, make sure it's safe for him to watch. There's nothing more disgusting than that sort of thing when you're not expecting it. Not ready for it, Maura, do you know what I mean? At his age, pure disgusting. You'd think it would have gone off him by now. Then he asked me to handle him. The very thought of it has put me off the chicken already. Absolutely revolting. Nearly as bad as the time he asked me to. No. No, I won't say it. I can't let it pass my lips. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.